From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, we dive deep into human trends. It's called Uncharted. It's an incredible research story by two professors. You're going to love it. Special shout out tonight, by the way, to Patrick, who has been emailing me all night. He asked for a shout out because he didn't believe it was me emailing him back. Patrick, it's me. Well, you know, when your time is up, it's up. A freak wave smashed through the windows of a cruise ship on the English Channel, killing an elderly man. The 85-year-old man and a woman in her 70s were airlifted from the MS Marco Polo after the incident. The cruise line pinned the tragedy on adverse sea conditions in the southwestern approaches of the English Channel. Just a huge wave smashed into the ship. The monstrous wave, it just plowed into 22,000 tons of that ship while it was heading for its home port of Tilbury. After a 42-night voyage, the wave was so forceful, it crashed straight through five of the ship's windows and injured the passengers inside and then killed that 85-year-old man. Bizarre story over the weekend. A teenage Satanist charged with the murder of a man she met through the Craigslist contact website has now admitted to killing at least 22 others. Miranda Barber could be one of America's most prolific female serial killers after making the confession to a Pennsylvania newspaper from her prison cell. The 19-year-old said she was just 13 when she began nationwide killing. It was a spree in her home state of Alaska. She says, "When I hit 22, I stopped counting." Well, police in the state are now working with the FBI and investigators all around the country to examine unsolved murders stretching from Texas to North Carolina and California. North Korean security chiefs and possibly even Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un himself could face international justice for ordering systematic torture, starvation, and killings comparable to what they say are Nazi-era atrocities. The investigators told Kim in a letter that they are advising the United Nations to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court to make sure any culprits, including possibly yourself, would be held accountable. So extreme feeling of loneliness on a long-term basis can be worse than obesity in terms of increasing the lethal health risks that lead to premature death, according to scientists. They say that chronic loneliness has been shown to increase the chances of an early grave by 14%, which is as bad, they say, as being overweight and almost as bad as poverty and undermining a person's long-term well-being, according to the study. Well, let's check in with our resident psychiatrist, Peter Bregan. Peter, why does loneliness affect your life?
Well, George, first of all, I want to say that it's normal to feel even dreadfully lonely. And that when you feel that kind of awful loneliness, the tendency is to think there's something the matter with you, or to think you're weird or different, or you don't belong on planet Earth, or you're from another time or something. But in fact, we human beings have such a profound need for meaningful contact with other people. It's in us. It's part of our DNA. But that expression hardly captures it. It's being a human being. So the first thing to realize is that it's not that there's something the matter with you, that you have these terrible feelings, but rather that it's a signal that you're not being fulfilled in a very basic way of having a meaningful relationship with individual people or with a group of people. People vary about that. And yes, it can be very debilitating to experience loneliness over a long period of time. It makes us depressed. It makes us ashamed. It makes us feel guilty. We don't take as good a care of ourselves.
Does it affect the heart just because you're lonely?
I think it could probably affect anything. You know, we talk about a broken heart and, you know, older people who lose a loved one sometimes themselves die from heart disease or something else very soon after the loss of a loved one. But other people, my much-loved mother-in-law, Ginger's mom, Jean, reach out after a time of mourning and become engaged with other people and give more to other people. Now, there's so many people who are lonely, and there's so many people who are in need, that we can always get out of our loneliness, to some extent at least, by reaching out.
Well, that's true. And Peter, one of the reasons why, for example, we broadcast live on holidays, because I think that's a very lonely time for a lot of people, and that's what we're here for. So if you're ever out there and you feel lonely, just find us on the dial somewhere for Coast to Coast AM. Peter, thank you. He's a great psychiatrist, gives us great information. An Oregon Democrat says he wants to create federal legislation that would set up for each child born in the United States a savings account as part of a major revamping of the country's tax code. Senator Ron Wyden, on track to become the Senate's top Democrat on tax policy, said he wants to draft legislation that would provide each child with a $500 savings account as a way to curb poverty. Problem is, by the time that child becomes an adult and needs the $500, it'll be worth about 22 cents sometime in the future. Hackers hit the crowdfunding site Kickstarter, made off with user information, although no credit card information, they say, was taken. The site said the attackers made off with usernames, email addresses, mailing addresses, phone numbers, and encrypted passwords as well. Well, you might think you have to pay through the nose at the moment to access the internet, but one ambitious organization called the Media Development Investment Fund is planning to turn the age of online computing on its head by giving free web access to every person on the planet. Known as the OuterNet, they plan to launch hundreds of satellites into orbit by 2015, and the group is hoping to raise tens of millions of dollars in donations to get the project on the road. Space historian Robert Zimmerman with us. You know, Robert, I looked at this story 20 times. I can't figure out how this company, even though they're going to try to get donations, is going to make money on the long term. It's not going to last, is it?
Well, you know, George, this is part of the overall increasing competition and energization, I think, of the space aerospace industry. I'm not sure this company is going to do it, but they've got some financing and they've got some good ideas, and the technology is improving in now that you can maybe do this for much less money. Now, where they're going to make the money, I'm not sure, but there's another story that's swirling around the space community these days. Last 2 days, a rumor that Google wants to put up a constellation of 1,600 satellites for the purposes of providing broadband internet access. Now, they want to make money by, you know, selling broadband, but provide it from space at, of course, much less money. And this is part of that same framework. The costs of getting into space are going down, and so therefore people are coming up with ideas to take advantage of that.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, it's a great idea, but I just don't know if it's going to happen.
Well, with Google, I take it much more seriously. They just took over leasing an airfield at Ames Research Center. Why would they do that? Big hangar there. They've got a project that is linked to this, doing research using internet access from balloons. This is happening, George. In some way or another, we're going to see a revolution, and it's going to come from space and space technology in this respect.
All right. Thank you so much. And Robert's website, of course, is behindtheblack.com. An asteroid with an estimated diameter of 3 football fields zoomed by the planet just late tonight, missing good old planet Earth by 2 million miles. Traveled at some 27,000 miles an hour. Let's check in with the astronomer, Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. 2 million miles, pretty close, isn't it, Stephen?
Absolutely, George. That's another close call for a rather large object like that, like you reported before. 3 football field size, that's the size of a rather, well, rather large ocean liner now, maybe like the Titanic of days gone by or modern ones. But the close passage was 1.6 million miles or so. And here's a little scoop on this asteroid. It's officially known as 2000 EM26. It was discovered back on March the 5th of 2000. And what's interesting, George, is the object has not been recovered since. It's come past the Earth every 269 days. But tonight, and many people around the world were watching, of course, the live coverage on SLU.com and their space cameras, and they had a live update from Dubai, of all places. But when the program ended, there was no confirmation at the time of actually picking up the object, very faint, very interesting. So I think it sends a message, George, to not only the listeners of Coast, but I would hope our government pays attention, don't you think? Of all the objects in space like these, called potentially hazardous asteroids, and it almost comes a little after a year when you and I were talking about asteroid 2012 DA14, and then we kind of broke some news as it was happening right on your show with the Chelyabinsk Russian meteorite. So small objects hitting the Earth and big ones making close passages. We need to keep our eyes to the skies, of course.
We sure do. A magnetic filament erupted from the sun's western limb, and because of its location on the sun's limb, the eruption fortunately did not send a coronal mass ejection toward us, but one day it could happen and, you know, knock out the power grid with an X-flare. Who knows? William Forstjen is joining us in a moment. One of his books, One Second After, as he examines the possibility of an EMP strike on the grid or an attack. Some things are breaking, and we checked in with him, and he's with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, William Forstjen, of course, professor of history, faculty member of Montreat College in North Carolina. He received his doctorate from Purdue University, specializing in military history. A couple works out there, Pillar to the Sky, about the elevator to the sky, and then One Second After, as we talk about EMPs and the incredible dangers of that. So many things have been happening lately. We thought we'd bring him back for an update. William, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
George, it's a pleasure to be with you again. And there was a lot of space news leading into this tonight.
Oh, my gosh. So much asteroids, everything. Everything, though, that you have been writing about in your book, One Second After, is out there. And I wanted you to update us on some things that have been happening since we last talked. What's new?
Well, there's been a lot of interest within the last month or two. A couple of media sources have picked up on this issue, and I found it interesting that one of the things they did focus in on, parenthetical to EMP, but a apparent terrorist rehearsal or even maybe a real attempt at taking out the power grid in San Jose, California, with a sniper putting holes into a major transmission site, that only came out in the news almost a year later. This happened April a year ago.
Did they suppress it? What happened there?
You know, I don't have the answer for you, George, whether it was suppressed or just simply overlooked, but it's only gained national attention, even congressional attention, within the last week or two. But yet again, it points out the fragility of our infrastructure system. And then the thing that really creeped me over the last week, since I tend to focus more on EMP, is this Iranian warship just boldly running up along our coast. What a rehearsal for a potential EMP strike.
Well,
that's how many people are starting to interpret it.
You and I have talked about the possibility of some nation, some rogue nation or otherwise, getting very close to the United States with portable missile launchers from ships. We probably have no idea where they were or who they were if they didn't fly with a flag. And then, you know, you launch a nuke into the atmosphere, it detonates, and it's history for us technologically, isn't it?
Absolutely. What you're describing there is if you pop by modern standards, a very low-yield nuke, not much bigger than a Hiroshima-sized detonation of around 20 kiloton. The gamma ray burst in that first millionth of a second, as it hits the upper atmosphere, sets up an electrostatic discharge, cascades down to the Earth's surface, builds as it goes, and then as it hits all of the hundreds of millions of miles of wiring, most likely billions of miles of wiring in the United States, they act as antennas, pick it up, and short-circuit out the grid.
You know, there are some nations that are suicidal, William, as they get technology. There are others that aren't. I do not believe that Russia is suicidal. I don't believe the Chinese are, though they'll go about it in a different way. India is not. Those countries that possess nukes. North Korea, they're nuts. And Iran, you know, they have that capability, not the people there. And I want to stress this for a moment. The people of Iran love our way of life. I can't tell you how many Iranians I've talked to who live in the California area here in Southern California. They love our way of life. They wish they could all come here. They're friendly. There's that group, that hatred, that small core that, you know, wants to disrupt the entire planet. But that core of the Ayatollahs there, they're the ones causing all this problem. They're the ones that I think are suicidal, William. I think they're capable of wanting to send a ship to launch a nuke, even if they know we're going to retaliate if we ever find out who did it.
Yeah, you hit a couple of very important points. I'm really glad that you pointed out that the average Iranian wants nothing to do with the madness of their leaders. Recall the last election, which was a fraud, and the millions of people who then turned out to protest, and how I prayed at that moment for a leadership like we saw with Ronald Reagan, backing up Solidarity and other movements in the 80s that ended communism, that we should remember providing more direct support to these people to stand up to their government. The Iranians were a very friendly people to us until the nut jobs took over. They aren't suicidal. And those of us old enough to remember can recall with Russia what was called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction.
That's right.
You throw nukes at us, we throw nukes at you, nobody wins. Let's not do it.
That's right. You may take out one of our cities. You take out one of our cities, but we're going to take out two of yours. And then it goes back and forth, and then we're all wiped out.
But that doesn't work with the madmen who are running Iran. Oh, by the way, your news item of earlier greatly reassured that the United Nations is going to take care of the North Korean little...
I hope so.
Call him something else. We'll call him a despot. He must be trembling in his boots knowing that the UN is upset with him.
They need to go in and take him. You know, the guy's
apparently
insane.
There's going to be an investigation of war crimes. I know how effective the UN has been in the past with those types of things.
Yeah.
But he's another classic example of somebody we should really be deeply concerned about because he's fully capable.
I mean, not to go off track, but I mean, this guy, you know, his uncle kind of wanted to upend him. So he had him arrested and killed, had him thrown to dogs, hungry dogs ate him. And then he went after every blood relative of the uncle, kids, women, anybody, and had them exterminated.
Mm-hmm.
He's insane. Yet Dennis Rodman can go there and play basketball with him.
I know. Wasn't that beyond surreal? I mean, Dennis Rodman, our diplomat is going to save us from the madness of North Korea.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what he'd say now about the guy who had everybody, you know, killed out there. Crazy.
Oh, right, I bet they're still buds.
But you know what? But you are right. He's capable, too. He's capable, too. And he's got a nuke. And, you know, once he gets this capability, he would do something like this.
You are hitting into my greatest fear here. I mean, it's been several years since One Second After came out, and I just see the situation is not being addressed. Again, let us go back to what you just mentioned. When we were dealing just with the Soviets and the Chinese, mutual assured destruction, they had as much to lose as we did, and they have though we might not like their system, the government, basically rationalists that are running it. When you have an irrationalist armed with a nuclear weapon, that is like a psychotic armed with a pistol, and you're locked in the same room with them.
Yep.
Sooner or later, somebody's going
to
get
try hurt. Going to sleep with a guy like that in your room, right?
Yeah.
One eye open all night. So something's got to happen. And I want to get into, in a moment when we come back with you, William, the technical end of how this would work. Update us again on this Iranian warship, what we're doing. I mean, we got the strongest Navy in the world. We got to kind of move this thing out. It's an old mothballed type ship, you know, rusty and everything else, but it still could carry any kind of nuclear payload. I mean, and that is something we have to watch out for. So we're going to come back in a moment. William Forstgen with us, a couple of his books. We'll talk also about his latest one, Pillar to the Sky, about the space elevator. That's an incredible story as well. He's with us for 2 hours. It's a split show tonight. So next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him right here on Coast to Coast AM, and as Patrick now knows, I do answer some of my emails. It is me, nobody else. Send it to me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Our guest, William Forstgen, as we talk about EMPs, electronic magnetic pulses, boom, anything could happen. So we're going to talk with him for another hour and a half about this. We'll take your calls with him next hour. And welcome back, William Forstgen, with us. William, first of all, let's go back to the sniper attack in San Jose that happened last year, hitting at the regional power grid. Some of the theories I'm hearing now, it might have been a test to see if they could really do this all around the country, and they were using this as a test site. Or two, it was just, you know, the act of a couple crazy people. Or, you know what? Who knows what? What do you think?
The disturbing thing for me is, it was about 4 years back, I was at the Army War College at Carlisle for several days of discussion on cybersecurity issues. And as I always try to emphasize when I'm talking with you, George, is I deal completely in the declassified and non-classified area.
Yes, you do.
So I don't want the NSA knocking on my door tomorrow morning and saying, why did you say that?
Yeah, why did you release that?
General information in the open. But this precise scenario was presented by an expert in this area, Professor Ayers, who, this is the precise scenario. She said, all you need is some hit squads to go to major transmission sites, hit those large kind of sci-fi looking things that are actually big tanks that are filled with oil to cool the transformer. And as that oil goes pouring out, the transformer blows.
Jeez.
And the report states that 17 out of 20 took hits within a matter of minutes. 17 out of 20 transformers at this one site. And it started to blow out the power grid for San Jose.
They knew what they were doing then.
They knew precisely what they were doing. They had the right caliber weapon. They were aiming at the right target. And within a matter of minutes, they popped 17 out of 20 major transformers. And again, this precise scenario was being talked about at the War College in Carlisle several years back. So when I heard this April a year ago, it creeped me out. And it's like, where's the response? We're only hearing about it now 10 months later.
I have always said, William, we should have troops stationed at every power plant, every nuke facility, and every general power plant.
Beyond that, these transformer centers could very easily be protected by just bunkering them.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Just put a shielded bunker around the transmission site, and it's protected from... We're talking about somebody with just a, what the media too often called, assault weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Just a good high-velocity rifle, and pop, 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 and suddenly you can blow out the power grid of an entire city.
And how close do they have to be?
Well, you know, I finally saw some surveillance camera footage that was taken of it. They're standing about 100 feet away. These things are protected by a chain link fence.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And they're that way all around the country, aren't they?
It's all over the country. We have a small power transformer site within a quarter mile where I live. I drive by it, and I think, gosh, it wouldn't take much to blow out this whole valley.
And the government's been very, very quiet about this.
That is what, when this was first discussed back in April a year ago, and I was attending the conference, and it came up, I was like, what the heck are you talking about? At first I thought, oh, yeah, some conspiracy theory or something like that. And the person was like, no, check out the San Jose News. There it is. It wasn't until an expert on the topic raised it in national media a couple of weeks ago that, oh, now suddenly Congress is running around throwing their hands up saying, we have to do an investigation of this.
Now, back to this Iranian warship. It hasn't gone into our waters at this point, correct?
Correct.
But if it did, do we have every right just to take it out?
Within the 12-mile limit.
Yeah.
But...
But they're smart enough not to do that at this point.
But a warship, any warship of today could carry as much firepower as all the warships of all the navies of World War II can be concentrated into one ship.
Oh, no question.
And I looked up during the break just the names of the ships. I can't help but smile at one. It has a support vessel named the Kong, which sounds very Klingon to me.
Yeah,
the Klingons are off our coast. Now, I can chuckle a bit, but at the same time, that can be a dry run for checking out how to put an EMP load up above the United States. Yet again, and you and I have talked about this before, remember, we're still being told that several years back off the coast of California, it was simply an optical illusion.
I still think that was a Chinese sub-launch, and they were trying to tell us, look what we can do.
Exactly. I mean, good heavens. It was an SLBM. It had all the characteristics of it, the contour trail, the trajectory, everything. And that was, what, 25 miles off the California coast?
From something
roaring out of the ocean?
No warhead, just a launch, just to simply say, look what we can do.
And our reaction time to an EMP launch like that off the coast, none.
No. No.
There is none, unless you have an Aegis sitting right on top.
I mean, we're going to have to rely on our submarines and their capabilities to launch against whatever nation might do something, because we're not going to react fast enough to protect anything here in the States.
Our magnificent anti-submarine warfare system created during the Cold War, with monitoring systems that could track, and almost every Soviet boomer had an attack sub, an American attack sub sitting on its tail. Those days are over. Talking to folks I knew in the Navy, they said our listening capabilities have absolutely degraded over the last 15 years. So not only do we have concern about Iranian surface vessels, but Koreans are falling around with subs. And as we just talked about the Chinese, I don't see the Chinese being the culprit at it. I definitely see the North Koreans doing something like that.
Well, you know, I wrote a paper when I was in high school, William. I mentioned this on the program before, and it had two scenarios, and it was for our political science class. And the scenario was you do one of two things. Either every nation advances technologically to a point where every nation has nuclear capabilities, and somebody's going to do something stupid one day, and you're going to have another world war, and it's going to be with nukes, and it's going to be a mess. There is that possibility. And the other one was to completely annihilate anybody that you suspect as being a potential threat to you, and never, ever let them have the technology to move forward with their civilization. As cruel as it might seem, that was another theory that I kicked out. And then we had the class discuss it. And most of the kids, 17, 18 years old, picked the second scenario. And that was completely annihilate all the time these rogue countries to keep them from getting that kind of technology. Now, that may sound like one of the most barbaric things you can do, but you know what? Wouldn't that eliminate these issues?
Well, we could use the technical term, preemptive first strike.
Constantly, on an ongoing basis. You know, you just basically keep them in the dark ages all the time. But what a disaster that would be, too.
We did a preemptive first strike. His name was Saddam Hussein. He had to be taken out. The weapon of mass destruction in Iraq, and I know this might take some folks off, but weapon of mass destruction was not the chemical weapons, which personally I think are being fired back and forth in Syria right now because they were smuggled out of Syria just before we went in.
Right.
It was the madman running the country who was a sadistic homicidal maniac who openly said he was going to try and take us out as well. We took him out first. Tough moral question, but then look at the political chaos it created in the United States afterwards.
Just a mess. So, I mean, what do you do? It's a tough question. I mean, do you take out the North Koreas and the Irans, knowing that their governments are insane and would do whatever they could to destroy us, even though the people are nice people?
Yeah, some folks might recall a movie from the early 60s called The Bedford Incident, in which an American destroyer is confronting a Soviet sub, and an accidental war starts when the main character says, if he fires one, I'll fire one. And a weapons officer goes, fire one, hits the button. The reason I'm thinking of that is the only way to prevent an EMT is to preemptively strike you. The moment it's fire one and that missile is away, unless you got an Aegis sitting right on top of it, in 5 minutes, the game is over. Therefore, the only way to prevent it is to prevent it from ever even starting, which means take it out before the weapon is even carried out.
Now, but what do you do with the countries like Russia, like China, who we don't want to fight with? What do we do with them when they see what we have done to these preemptive strikes against some of these other nations? Do they think we're next?
I want to actually believe that there's enough for it, because if not, George, I don't know how many more conversations we're going to have, but suddenly one day it's all gone. I want to believe the Chinese and the Russians have rationalists as leaders who might scream and pound the table in public, but inwardly breathe a sigh of relief.
Right.
Because remember, Iran is a hell of a lot closer to Russia than it is
us. And maybe this has worked out with them before anything happens.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If we have a rational, and I had to point out, rational and then underlying three times over, intelligent president who understands foreign policy correctly, that phone call would be made before. It'd just simply be, hey, sit back quietly for the next 12 hours. One of your neighbors is going to disappear, but it's to the benefit of all of us. But let me emphasize, you opened so correctly on a moral question. It's not the Iranian people we're after. It's the leadership. We have to preemptively take some of them out.
That's right.
But the vast majority of Iranian people would cheer us on as well.
Oh, they would. No question about it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, they would love to see a regime change there.
I was in the Soviet Union in 86. I was involved in all things back then on a bit of a diplomatic thing tied into a joint space program. I had some students with me. And people in America wouldn't believe when I came back. I said, you know who the greatest hero is in Russia today? Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, you're
right. They're not afraid of him. They love him. They're saying to me, tell Ronald Reagan to keep doing it because he's the guy that's going to set us free. He was a hero in Russia. That was in 1986.
Well, and he knew what to do. He knew how to generate the collapse from within.
Exactly. And that is my frustration, that Reagan understood that. He, Maggie Thatcher, Pope John Paul II, knew how to play the solidarity movement in Poland into a uprising across the entire Eastern Europe. We had that same opportunity to take out the Iranian regime from within, and we let the ball drop.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, you know, I got to tell you, you know, we during the hostage situation, right after that, that's when we should have really gotten tough.
Again, in praise of my favorite leader, remember 15 minutes after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as president, the hostages were released because he sent a clear message. Release them now or Tehran ceases to exist within 24 hours. They scrambled. They knew they were up against a real leader.
Unbelievable. So give me a perspective of an EMP, whether it's a solar flare from the sun or a nuke. And would they both have the same consequences? An X flare, a big one, and a nuke?
An EMP military from a nuke versus a CME. Different types of frequencies, different ways of impact, but the result is the same. In my book, One Second After, which is a novel about what would happen in a small town across the span of 1 year, a character actually does say, gosh, was something happened with the sun? Was there a solar flare? I couldn't help humorously writing in a little bit. Another character looks at the sun and says, well, it's still shining. Don't tell me something's wrong up there. We could have a major solar flare. The sun wouldn't look any different, but the impact would be the same. The big difference between an EMP and triggered by a nuclear weapon and a CME, coronal mass ejection, is EMP instantaneous. CME, we since it travels slower than the speed of light.
Couple days.
Visual on it. We would have 8 to 12 hours warning before it did this.
Right. But if we haven't insulated the grid by then, it's not going to help anyway.
So it gives us 8 to 12 hours to panic, run around, buy a lot of bread and milk, or go to church.
Yeah, exactly. And then the grid could be out for how long? Because I do believe we are going to get hit by an X flare, a big one, one day.
Okay, here's the depressing stuff again. Some very reliable folks on this who really crunched a number point out that 5 years after a major EMP or CME, 80% of our power generating capability would still be offline.
80%. How many deaths?
5 years later.
How many deaths? 300 million Americans. How many deaths would occur if we're only at 20% capacity over 5 years?
I will say low end, and I'm saying only. Think of how horrifying this is. Only 30 million Americans dead, low end estimate. 270 million Americans, close to 90% dead, high end estimate.
Jeez.
The greatest catastrophe in the history of humanity.
And what would cause the death? Starvation? Freezing in the winter, things like that?
Well, let's just look at how the eastern half of the United States was crippled by one snowstorm last week. Imagine that with absolutely no electricity whatsoever when the storm hits and then afterwards. Whatever time of year, first of all, heating or cooling, which we're absolutely dependent on. I remember doing a local radio broadcast in Phoenix where the host was rather dismissive of the issue. They went to the weather forecast. It was like another typical day in Phoenix, high of 108, low of 92. And when we came back on, I said, how many elderly in Phoenix would be dead in 24 hours if you lost your power grid?
Yeah, without air conditioning in that kind of sweltering heat.
It's water, first of all.
That's true.
Every city in America is dependent on electricity to deliver clean, safe water and then flush away all the stuff needed for safe sanitation.
And the water gets to our house, not from pressure, but from electrical pumps that are pushing it to us.
And goes through filtration systems first that are pumped. The city, New York City, would become uninhabitable within 24 hours. San Francisco, Denver, Los Angeles, all of them uninhabitable because there's no water.
And with the X flare, is it not the portion of the planet that is facing the sun when those X flares finally hit? They take 2 days. So let's say it's, you know, the sun bursts an X20, but the United States is on the other side. And so what gets hit during that 2 day period, let's say, is all of Europe or something like that. Is that possible?
No, you're looking at a global event because as the world turns, that great old soap opera that I used to listen to with my grandmother.
Like Sands of the Hourglass. Yeah. Or the days.
Exactly. The Earth is rotating. And beyond that, the magnetosphere, which surrounds us and protects us, doesn't matter which side you're on. That envelops and the disturbance runs through the magnetosphere. And also, it's not just bang, it hits, and it's over with. It is like a storm. It's like a hurricane.
Just keeps coming. Bang, bang.
It just keeps coming. And the great one that is the first actual recording of such an event is known as the Carrington event.
That was the one in the
1800s. 1859. Yep. And it blew out the telegraphy systems in the eastern United States.
Well, that's the only technology they had then. If that size hit today, what a mess. William, we're going to come back and want to talk a little bit about Pillar to the Sky, the space elevator, and then, of course, we'll take phone calls just ahead on Coast to Coast AM.